Hello, Doomer Optimist. This is Going Godward for Doomer Optimism. Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the pod. Today, I have Nathaniel Marshall with us, Nate, Oblate Nate on Twitter. Thanks for being with me.
It is an absolute pleasure. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited too. So, I've known Nate through Twitter, through X, whatever we're going to call it, for quite a while. He has had some really profound thoughts that he shares there. He writes, he has a blog, a website called The Blue Scholar. He has been published in Christianity Today, where he wrote a little bit about work and about his role, his trade in plumbing. He's Doomer Optimist adjacent for sure. I think he just came back from a trip to Madison, Wisconsin, where he got to hear Paul Kingsnorth. And anyone who's in the Doomer Optimist world knows who Paul Kingsnorth is, and probably even beyond the Doomer Optimist crowd. So, Nate, I believe you live in Georgia.
I do.
Yes, I got a family there, and I'm just going to open it up, let you give us a little bit of a bio, so that the crowd who doesn't know you can know a little bit about you. So, feel free, go ahead.
Sure. So I am Nathaniel Marshall. I was born in Long Beach, California, and I lived there until I was 10. My parents decided that they needed to move to Texas for whatever reason they had. I wasn't privy to those reasons. And we moved to Texas. That was the summer between fifth and sixth grade for me. I was there for basically all of junior high and high school. I say basically because the first semester of eighth grade was back in California again. We thought we were going to move back. That didn't work out. My parents said, "Sorry, Merry Christmas. We're moved to Texas." And so we go back to Texas. I finished high school there and then moved back to California day after high school graduation. I was there for 7 years. And then a Let's see, in that 7 years, I met who the woman who had become my wife. We had two children, two daughters, and then we 8.5 years ago, June of 2015, moved from California to Georgia, and we've been here ever since.
Wow. So are your parents still? Where are they?
So, funny story. I'll keep it short. My grandparents, my parents, my wife and I, our girls, my brother, and my grandparents' dog all came to Georgia
Oh,
in
wow.
one fell swoop. So it was like mass migration from one coast to the other.
Okay. What moved you? I mean, like, what ultimately made you want to settle finally in Georgia?
For us, it was primarily the cost of living and just the fact that if my grandparents had independently made the decision to move to Georgia. They had one of my uncles lived a couple cities over from us and here where I'm in currently. And my grandparents had watched half of their grandchildren grow up, but the other half were here in Georgia and wanted to kind of spend some years with them. And so they're like, "Yeah, we're going to move to Georgia." And then for me, my family, we were talking about like it is so expensive to live here, among other reasons why you might not want to live in California. And we got to get out. Where are we going to go? And I had a family friend that worked at my current employer. She was in accounting at the time, and she said, "Hey, I heard you got into the trades. If you ever decide you want to move out this direction, then I can get you an interview." And I was like, "Oh, awesome." Thinking like maybe when I got licensed in California, maybe in a couple years I'd go out there. Which I said to her, and she was like, No, we need apprentices. We need people like now." And I was like, So we had the conversation, and we're like, "Yeah, I think we're just gonna go for it." And so called the family together and told my grandparents and my parents, "Hey, we're gonna go to Georgia." My grandparents are like, "Funny story, we're going to Georgia too." And then my parents are like, "Well, if y'all are going to Georgia and y'all are going to Georgia, then we are also gonna go to Georgia." And so boom, we were all here.
How interesting. So you've talked a little bit about your trade. You haven't, I think I mentioned it in the very beginning, you are a plumber, which we've all had to have a plumber. I can attest to reaching out to Nate in a DM a few months ago whenever my kitchen sink was completely full of water and would not drain. So he is legit plumber. And he answered lots of questions for me. So, I want to go now into the piece that you wrote for Christianity Today, where you talk about your trade. And it was really interesting because what you shared in that piece was that you kind of had clergy in mind. You thought that that was the direction that you would go, and that you felt like that was just kind of where you were being called to, but ended up taking a totally different turn. But you were able to talk about how your role as a plumber, how your trade has drawn you closer to the divine, has made you more inward, has developed your inner life and your relationship with God. Can you just say more about that?
Yeah, so I had from the time I was a kid, I had a sort of a somewhere between a vague and a definite sense, whatever's between that, that was that I had like a desire, a draw to ministry, but I didn't know exactly what that was going to look like or how that was going to shape up. Well, I went to the church that we were in when I was still in California was a non-denominational church and with a seminary, as non-denominations have, I guess. And it was a 2-year program, and I went through that expecting that immediately after getting out of that program, I would interview a couple churches maybe, and then get on as a high school or college pastor or something. And I went to more than 2 interviews, had less than 1 offer. And was like, wow, this is not working out the way that I had anticipated or that I'd hoped for. And so knowing that I didn't go to college, I graduated high school and went right to work. So when I was there thinking like, what am I gonna do with my life? I was working customer service for a property management company and was absolutely miserable and was like, I can't get out of this into something that is super high paying because I don't have a college degree. And the ministry thing is maybe on the table, maybe not. I was still interviewing at the time. And so I was like, well, my dad's a tradesman. My grandpa's a tradesman. My great grandpa was a
And
tradesman.
plumbing?
No, not none of them plumbers.
Okay.
None of them plumbers. Also, by the way, I am the least handy guy you've ever met at the time. I know nothing. I
That's
don't know the difference.
encouraging. That's encouraging for
Yeah,
all of us. Yeah.
I knew nothing, no skills at all, and I was like, well, maybe the blue collar thing is like in my blood somewhere, and I heard the voice of Mike Rowe, the host of Dirty Jobs and others. I heard his voice kind of echoing through my memory. I'd watched an episode or an interview with him where he had said that his grandpa had told him that maybe he needed to find another toolbox because he wanted to be a tradesman but was absolutely terrible at it. But for me, it was like, I'm trying to not be a tradesman, and maybe the toolbox, an actual toolbox, is what I should pick up. And so, yeah, I talked to one of my pastors at church, and he was like, I know a guy who owns his own plumbing company here. And I was like, well, and on that day, sorry, not that day. So he introduces me to the guy. I interview with the guy who becomes my first boss. But before he was my boss, he called me back, and a pastor, they called me back on the same day within
Wow.
like 2 hours of each other. And so I went from like super stoked, like, yeah, I got a job, to, oh my gosh, the thing that I really wanted all came through. What am I going to do? And ultimately, what it came down to was I had to choose between, at the time, what I felt was a more and a less wise decision. The pastoring thing was something I desired, but I also recognized that I didn't know what it meant to live a Christian life. I was kind of floundering in my sin, not increasing in holiness, reading texts of scripture and being told that like you're gonna walk in righteousness, you're gonna have the power of God literally living in you and transforming you and all this other stuff. And I'm like dutifully sitting there doing nothing. I can't work for it, right? Because if you sweat for Jesus, that's works righteousness. And so I'm sitting there like waiting for something to happen, and the Holy Spirit never flicked the switch. So I was like, well, I guess I'm not good at being a Christian, so maybe pastoring isn't a great choice for me, and I'll go the plumbing route, and plumbing pays a lot more than the pastorate. So yeah, I chose plumbing and discovered that through really paying attention to the circumstances of plumbing, really paying attention to the needs of my coworkers and my customers, and just paying attention to the material that I was working with, like just digging, like there's 1,000 lessons to be learned from digging a hole. There's so
What's
much
a lesson?
there.
Tell us a lesson about from digging a hole.
Man, so what? One of the things that I was fixing a water service. Actually, this was last year, and it occurred to me that what happened was that where the water service, the main water line going from your meter to your house, where it penetrates the foundation wall, what can happen is over time, ground that is on top of the pipe and under the pipe all settles. And as it settles, it can bend at the foundation wall. And what's going through the wall isn't bending, just right there at the wall. So it bends, 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 and eventually the material, whether it's a plaque or copper or whatever else, will split. You start getting a leak into the surrounding ground, and then that just that intensifies the settling. The water causes the ground to settle even more, which bends the pipe more, which makes the leak worse, which makes the ground settle more, and it's just a cycle, right? And I don't know why it occurred to me, but I'm just sitting here looking at this and going like, man, that is so like our souls. Like our souls settle. If we're not, and not that you would go out into the yard and like stir the dirt up necessarily to keep it from settling, like it's a natural process, but as it pertains to our interior life, it's so easy for us to kind of get trampled over for that compaction to happen inside of us, which then puts pressure on the interior plumbing, supposed to be carrying something like the water of living, like living water through us, right? And eventually, that pressure just causes us to not attentive, if we're not careful, causes a leak. And then all of a sudden we slip into disorder and it just compounds and compounds. And so, yeah, that's just like one easy thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, that's so good. You know, a lot of our, just to kind of tie it into what our typical, I think the typical doomer optimist audience member follower is kind of interested in, which is kind of self-sustainability, localism, kind of charting your own path, rejecting modernity in some sort of way. And it really seems like you have been able to do that not only in your trade, but how your trade has kind of shaped, like you're saying, your interior life. So I think that like kind of moving in a self-sustainability way, just for a second, I want to kind of jump over here for a second. I don't know how much do you do a lot of plumbing, like setting up like houses, or do you just kind of do more repair type stuff, or what is your role, like what do you do mostly?
So the plumbing industry is pretty diverse. I specifically and exclusively do home service and repair. So I'm only going into people's homes. I'm only going into homes that are already built. I don't do renovations. It is specifically like they have a thing wrong and I go in and fix it and then that's it.
Do you have any ideas about installing? I mean, because we have a lot of people who are kind of roughing it. I mean, they're trying to figure out, they're maybe don't have running water on their property. They're wanting to, you know, develop indoor plumbing, that kind of thing. Develop, you know, they want to have a bathroom in their house. Like
Sure.
any suggestions about that for people?
So there are ways. If you have like a natural source of water around you, there are people who can like build a well. You can build a well house and install a pump that would provide that create generates the pressure that will pump the water into your house. And then as far as the plumbing itself goes, there are codes. I mean, there are codes for a reason. I think there's some debate as to what those reasons might be, but code exists, and a lot of it is good, like and helpful. Even if code enforcement can be a little, they can be jerks sometimes. But yeah, it's plumbing is more complicated than simply gluing pipe together, but it's not as complicated as building a rocket. Like it is not rocket science. And there are better and worse ways to do it. And there's certain configurations of things that it's like, now I get why we do it like this and not like that. But if you're roughing it and you're trying to build something that is going to provide just a baseline, like nothing super fancy. You're not looking for like complex body spray set up in your, you know, 10 right. by 10 walk-in shower.
You just want to have yeah. a toilet and a sink with running water.
Yeah, yeah. Then it's very doable.
Yeah. So just kind of in the, also like in that vein, and I want to go like to your Blue Scholar work and then talking about this. I think one thing that appeals to this crowd, the Doomer Optimist crowd, is mm-hmm. is the sustainability. We're kind of breaking away from what we would typically see, like kind of corporate America, that sort of thing. Certainly your trade allows you flexibility, freedom, that you might not have in an office job or even like in a clerical role, like as a clergyman. What would you say have been some of the benefits of being in your role, like having your own trade, and also some things that have been like kind of a struggle, like, hey, if I was going to give some advice to my younger self or to someone who was starting out on this, this is what I would do differently, or this is what would work for me. What would you say?
Well, the benefits, besides some of the spiritual stuff, which we've already touched on, just the acquisition of skills. There are so many things that I know outside of my trade now that I didn't know before, like having to do with framing. If I needed to frame in something, I know how to do that now because I have to frame in walls sometimes in open basements where I need to have something to run pipes through, which kind of falls on the Russian side, but every once in a while I dabble. Knowing how to do electrical work, knowing how to, particularly in my industry, or rather my sector of the industry, we are constantly talking to people. And so I've kind of developed an emotional intelligence as well, because you have to, at the end of the day, when you're in somebody's home and they have a plumbing issue, they are having an emotional crisis, not a plumbing crisis. The plumbing causes the issues, but the plumbing, like my first job is something of a therapist. Like my primary goal is to restore peace in a home, right? Like there's been this rift in the relationship between a homeowner and the house that they dwelled in safely and peacefully up until this thing started happening. And so my primary job is to restore that, to mend that relationship. I happen to do that by plumbing, but that's not what they're
that's
buying.
Beautiful though. That's so good. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the upside. I get to do that for people. The downside, particularly in the service industry, is the hours. I don't have as flexible of a schedule as I might in an office, where the office is pretty, you know, structured and regimented as far as, you know, you get there at 9, you leave at 4 or 5 or whatever. In the service industry, across the trades, you start when the first call is scheduled and you're done when they're done, and you know, I can't get to 5 o'clock and my customer's toilet is still overflowing and it's like, well, time to wrap it up, see you tomorrow. Like, it's not going to happen, you know. So that can be a bit of a strain, but it is it's just part of the calculus. I mean, if you love the work, if you are dedicated to doing it, then it's not that bad. If you've got a family, that makes it harder, because, you know, you'll have a significant other that'll be probably want you home, particularly if you've got kids. They're like, come help me. And it's like, well, I'm helping this other person. And it can cause some tension, but it's, you know, it's something you get used to.
Yeah. What are some, I think that, It seems like the kind of people who kind of embark on these journeys of self-sustainability, of entrepreneurship, of homesteading, whatever, it seems like they all kind of have some personality trait that sets them apart from the person who is like, I'm just going to be in my nice, cozy corporate job, my spreadsheet job, you know, whatever. What would you say is the kind of personality, the kind of traits that make someone like you successful, or someone who's starting out homesteading or something like that? What is needed? And also, what are some of the things that you kind of have to die to if you want to have this life where you're breaking away from what might be expected of you by the world?
I think the kind of person that sees value in this kind of life, I think they tend to realize that, and however the awakening happens, there tends to be a moment where they realize that the structures and the systems that are built around us, that are offering these particular whatever, that offering us a particular vision of the good life, is not that great. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's a particular quality necessarily, or a personality trait. Maybe that person trait or that quality develops over time, but I think there's just it seems to me like there's just a sudden realization that, like, there's more to life, isn't there? There's more to me being a human than simply waking up, being advertised to, constantly consuming, going to bed, waking up and doing it all again. And I think that probably the top thing you have to die to is a desire for ease. I think the longing for ease is a dis-ease. It's a disease to really long for. And I would say that ease and rest are different, right? So I'm not saying don't take a break. What I am saying is that if you constantly want everything to be easy, and if the market is continually offering to us easier and easier and easier options, there's something in difficulty, there's something in risk that is tied up in our personhood, that is tied up in our formation as humans. And to reject the difficulty and to reject risk is to sort of become this sin-souled, amorphous individual who just, like, has suddenly discovered that they've got no purpose and no meaning, and they can't, that everything is shallow and hollow, and so I don't know if that.
No, that's so good. That's so good. Because, I mean, that's something that I've even been talking about recently, is like, you know, I think I tweeted about this. Do I say tweet? I posted about this. Like, I feel like I've been able to mortify some of those really embarrassing sins, you know, sins, shortcomings, whatever. Like, I've been able to mortify those. And now it's all these little things that I constantly struggle to just, you know, I want the ease. Like, the ease is, I want to sit on my couch. I want to watch Lord of the Rings. I want to read a book. I don't want to wash the dishes. I don't want to fold the laundry. And then I'm mad at myself because the laundry basket is full and I'm having to dig for, you know, socks or whatever. And it's just like, I just said my name. Okay, well, that was great. Okay, I don't know if they'll edit that out or not. Anyway, I'll say to myself, like, what if you had just, like, not watched Lord of the Rings for the bajillionth time and folded your laundry, then you wouldn't be having to dig for socks at 7:59 when you're trying to get out of the house at 8 o'clock, you know, kind of thing. So I really love that you mentioned, if you want this kind of life, if you want to live a rich, good life, if that's what you want, you have to accept that there's not going to be just a ton of ease. You're going to have to embrace that hard thing, and you're going to have to die to that desire to just, you know, have things easy. And you're right, we are constantly being advertised at, and there's so much pressure to do the easy thing, like, that it's so accessible, the easy is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's so good.
And it's even like little seemingly benign or, I don't know, innocuous things. Like, my brother, for instance, because we talk about this kind of stuff a lot. My brother, he's got a hand coffee bean grinder, and he grinds a band. It's like one step up from a pestle and mortar, you know? I'm like, I don't ask him this. I get it. But, like, he lived with some other guys at one point, and they're like, what are you doing? And he was like,
right.
I'm doing it the hard way, because it's probably good for me to do it the hard way. And, like, that was the extent of his rationale. It wasn't like, there wasn't like some deep underlie. It was just like, it's the hard way, and the hard way is normally the better way. So I just do it that way. Mm. And it was like, well, there you go. The key is like, the coffee doesn't taste any better. He's like, it's not, it doesn't improve the quality of the flavor or the experience of drinking the coffee. It's just, it's a slightly more inconvenient way of doing it, which trains my soul. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, there's a book that I absolutely loved. I think I recommend it to you, How to Be Unlucky by Joshua Gibbs. And I just loved that book. And in it, he talks about the grinding of the coffee versus, you know, the drip coffee that you might, and he kind of talks about the orientation of our heart, the orientation of our soul to, you know, the coffee. And he brings up about the grinding of the coffee and how it has the potential to, you know, transform us in some way. Not saying that anybody that uses drip, I use drip, sometimes the drip pour over. I'm not, you don't grind your own coffee beans. We're not gonna, whatever.
I use a Keurig. So
yeah, whatever.
Like, sorry.
Yeah, but I think that like people who are kind of trying to train themselves to enjoy processes and learn something about themselves in doing something that's a little hard, a little painstaking. So I want to switch gears for just a half a second and say you went to Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You got to hear the Paul Kingsnorth.
The Paul Kingsnorth. Speak.
What was that like?
Man, it was really fantastic. So I'm not used to being around intellectuals. So take that for what it's worth. So sitting there, like hearing people quote other philosophers and theologians and stuff in person was like a really weird, like I watch YouTube videos of people talking about and quoting other smart people. To be in the presence of other people doing it was like, whoa, this is so crazy. These people are so smart. So that was my initial impression.
Right. Right.
But hearing Paul specifically was really cool. I really got this sense, if you followed his writing, and he talks about his conversion a few years ago to Christian Orthodoxy.
Yeah, for those who don't know, like the cross and the machine was like his big piece about his conversion. If you might hear has not read it, go ahead.
Yeah, and you can really tell at this particular presentation that he spent 30 years preparing for the 3 years, and then these 3 years in a very real sense kind of led to this keynote that he was giving. He has such a broad grasp on things, which is intentional on his part, right? Like he's trying to understand all these disparate things about our current existence and sort of drawing a thread between all of them. And so hearing him talk about the three P's, you know, like people, I'm missing the middle one, people, place, and prayer, having a people, having a place, and having prayer as being sort of like the summation of what a culture needs, of every culture requiring a sacred source from which everything else grows, whatever you name that divine power, whatever you name source, there has to be something that is transcendent and above that gives direction and meaning and integrity to a culture that kind of pulls it all together into a wholeness. And our decided lack of wholeness in this moment and the sort of the group feeling of being very unrooted and I think I used the word amorphous earlier, and I would apply that to here too. So yeah, it was really nice getting to hear him kind of wax eloquent on some of this stuff. And there are some people who didn't push back on him directly or hard, but some alternate or maybe slightly less than resonant ideas. Actually, I think Ashley had mentioned in her presentation about how the machine isn't out there. Like the machine is in us too. And we are part of it, and it is part of us. And so part of either breaking free from the machine or living adjacent to it, or however you want to think about it, requires repentance, let's say, change on our own part, which kind of gets back into, you know, the practical outflowing of all that. How do we actually accomplish it? But yeah, it was really good. Also, Wisconsin, the cheese curds, they grow golden fried on heavy laden branches and then fall to the ground next to on the banks of rushing ranch rivers. It's you just pick them up and dip them straight in, and it's
So funny.
incredible.
Yeah,
Incredible.
I've never been to the Midwest. So, I mean, I've been to Ohio and Indiana. I guess those are Midwest, but I think of like Wisconsin, Illinois. Like, I feel like that's more Midwest.
It was my first time as well. Sorry, my second time. And it was, I'm smitten. It was
Really?
incredible. The colors, the patchwork farmlands, and the barns, like the bright red barns and silos. And I was like,
Oh, now I gotta go.
should
Now
have gone.
I need Paul Kingsworth to come back next fall so I can make a trip. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now we're talking about Paul Kingsnorth. We're talking about kind of the three Ps that he mentioned we need to kind of bring our culture out of its rotten state. What would you say, just doom or take on the culture? What would you say is your doom or take?
If I was going full black pill,
Give it
like
to us. We're ready, Nate.
just
Yeah.
swallow the whole bottle.
Okay. You can take it.
It would probably be something like the, I don't know, like the AI, the robots are going to take over, and we are all going to become something like the Matrix. Like we are going to be, we are human batteries that are powering this thing. Right now, it's by choice, right? As in, we are consumers from the market, so we're choosing to participate in it. But eventually, all choice gets removed from the entire project, and there is a real determinism that becomes dictated by the machine and whoever happens to be in charge of it. That would be something like my doomer take.
Yeah, I've always used the idea of a zombie. Like I know, like I feel like machine, robot, zombie—they kind of are all interchangeable. They all kind of serve the same role, which is kind of getting into the minds and spirit of the people and
Yeah.
making them complacent, unable to think independently, to have the energy to step out and do something outside of the machine. So that's pretty gloomy. I gotta say the AI stuff freaks me out. I've talked about how my students have started doing the character AI. And I know some people who do it and they think it's super neat. I know some adults who do it and they think it's super neat. And when I first heard about it, I was like, oh, that's weird. I mean, I haven't done it. I've just heard people talk about it. I'm like, oh, that's weird. That's interesting, you know. But I'm seeing kind of some antisocial behavior, like an increased as if teenagers could become more antisocial, you know, just more antisocial behavior because they, like I said, can have friendships with LeBron James and sit at the lunch table and, you know, message him or whatever, and not really him, but his character. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a digital Ouija board or something. Like you're speaking with the, it's like, I
Spirit
think,
of, yeah, but it's
yeah,
not the real
whoever.
spirit of that person. It's like a pseudo spirit of that person. It's very
Right.
strange. So that's pretty sad. What's your optimist take?
My optimist take is that I don't actually think that's going to happen. I don't think that it gets that far, or if it does get close to that, it doesn't last long. I genuinely believe that the human need for agency will ultimately be the catalyst for kind of turning Titanic around and avoiding the iceberg. It's which, as a Christian, I would say that that's all guided by God's providence. I think the gospel is ultimately that my optimist take, that there is truly a different, most true human way of existence that is fully inaugurated one day, and that we are here to, those of us who believe and those of us who are looking for this way of the hard path, the human path, are doing our best to answer the prayer that Jesus taught us to pray, and that we are building God's kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven, that's our project, and that ultimately that project will be completed. And yeah. It looks nothing like my doomer take.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you kind of, it reminded me of a conversation I had with Brian Fink, who I interviewed for Doomer Optimism. I don't know when his is coming out, it should be soon. But we just kind of talked about the role of suffering in the good life and in becoming who we ought to be. And I think that ties into kind of what you were talking about, people accepting that it is not easy to do these things. And there is at least some low level suffering that you have to do. You know, you do have to suffer when you want to dig a hole to repair a line. You know, whenever I have to get up and carry loads of laundry up and down the stairs, or, you know, go pull all the weeds out of my weed bed so my flowers can grow and things like that. But there is a lot of tending, and there is a lot of, you know, there is pain and there is suffering in cultivating, I think, the good life, you know, either in the physical sense or in the spiritual sense.
Well, can I go theological just for a sec? Yeah. So even going back to the garden, and this is an inference, the text doesn't explicitly say this, but from sort of reading, I guess, something like philosophy back into it a little bit, like virtue is a good moral habit and it has to be practiced. And I think if there's a thing that hurts us more than anything else, it's maybe our desire for ease, but I think that the corollary to that is my desire for ease is attended by a lack of patience to wait for and work for what is actually good. And I think in the garden, even our parents, Adam and Eve, who were created and put not into nature, they were put into garden, right? So there's this cultural dynamic to that is already existent, designed by God so that they would go in there and take up the work and do the work in the garden of tending to it and paying attention to each plant and each cultivar and paying attention to each species of animal and paying attention to all the flowers and everything else. And for what purpose? To make it flourish, right? Like why else have a vegetable garden than you want the vegetables to consume? Well, they were working. Perhaps there hadn't been a harvest yet. And when they're just thinking that maybe we did something wrong, or maybe we're not what we're doing, maybe in that moment is when Satan slithers over and says, well, you know, there is that one fruit, you know, that God told you not to eat, but it's the best one. And it's probably better than any of the ones that you could grow. So why don't you just go and eat that? And so in that one temptation, in that one grasping, there they got to skip the labor. They got to skip the hard stuff and have the thing that they were working for anyway, right? If somebody can provide me the thing that I'm working for anyway, then they work for it. I can just go over here and get it. It's prepackaged waiting for me on a shelf.
Yeah. That's a very good point.
So all that to say that the work, even in the garden, like suffering is not a post-lapsarian or a post-fall reality. That virtue, the cultivation of virtue, is actually a painful process, even in a state of perfect righteousness. And so it's just part of our existence as humans. We can't get away from it.
Mm-hmm. Just talking about cultivating things in a garden and that kind of thing. You have some chickens.
Boy, do I.
You have some chickens. I know you grew some tomatoes.
Yeah.
Grew some other things this summer. How was that? How's your first venture with the chickens?
Yeah, so I actually had one die recently. I was lazy one night and didn't want to go out and close
Oh,
the
I remember you
coop.
said something about that, like.
Yeah, so I didn't so I've got it closed. I've got a run closed in. So I went into the run, and normally I go into the run, walk over to the side door, move the ramp out of the way, close them in, we're good. Didn't do it one night. Came out the next morning, or looked out of my window and saw feathers everywhere. And I was like, it's a lot of feathers. I don't like this. And yeah, long story short, I lost one. But that aside, the chicken thing has been awesome. Just the project of building the coop and raising them from basically chicks, like just a week out of the egg, to what they are now. And now they're laying, and I've got like 20 some odd eggs sitting on my counter right now.
Good.
That whole process has been awesome. The gardening thing has been interesting because I realized the end of summer, when stuff started not producing anymore, and I kind of let it, just be there, and stop tending to it. I realized I actually got a pretty good crop from everything, beans and cucumbers and squash and all kinds of stuff. But also, nobody in my house cooks. And so it was like, that was kind of pointless, wasn't it? Like, it was kind of pointless.
It's not pointless.
Well, what I mean is, like, I gave a lot of it away, which was, that's fine, that's great, but like, I actually have to know what to do with it after I grow it. And I didn't have, like, I didn't grow up in a
Not just
house
like
where my parents
slice the
cooked.
tomato and put some salt on it and like eat it like that, or did you put it on a sandwich? You're in Georgia. Why are you not eating a tomato sandwich?
Yeah, well, I did do that a couple times, but you can only have so many, and
That's
like there's
true.
only
That's true.
there
I
I
don't
can
know. I
only
love a tomato sandwich.
I
Should have.
they're what's are you what's your mayo of choice?
So I use Duke's mayonnaise.
Dukes, I knew it. You are definitely from the South.
Yeah, I use Duke's. That's what I've used for forever. I mean,
Yep.
that's all I ever used. So
Yeah,
Duke's
that's
mayonnaise.
fair.
Yes.
Anyway, so yeah,
It
there
was a
was.
good experience for you.
It was a good experience, and I'm going to continue it into the fall and winter. I
That's good.
was just started writing down sort of my plans for what's going to happen over these next couple of seasons, and what I want to harvest later and all that. So
That's great.
yeah, I love it.
Yeah, so good. We're wrapping up here at the end. I want to ask a couple more things. Well, I want to ask one thing and I want to talk about one thing. What should the Doomer Optimists be reading? What should they be studying? If they are wanting to develop their interior life and also cultivate a rich physical life, a growing things, sustaining themselves, building something, creating something. What do they need to be reading, thinking about, meditating on, listening to?
I think that there are, well, if you're into this and not garden, then you should probably be reading on gardening. I use the square foot method, the square foot gardening method, which there is like the seminal text on it, the man that developed the method. There's like a, I don't know, fourth or fifth edition of it. It's really, really good, really helpful, lots of instructions. On the more I guess, intellectual or philosophical side of things, one of the big names right now, he's like the patron saint of work, is Matthew B. Crawford. He's a political philosopher who is a motorcycle mechanic. He's actually fabricating custom motorcycle parts now. He doesn't work in an auto shop per se, but he is just a brilliant thinker and is really, really articulating this very well, this idea of what it means for us to work in the world and sort of the mule formation.
Okay, we're back. We had a little technical difficulty.
Whoops.
Yep, just a little Wi-Fi issue. Okay, so when we left off, we were talking about just books, thinkers, who people should be listening to, people in the Doomer Optimist camp, and also just anyone to rightly order themselves and their lives and to kind of ground themselves in reality. You brought up Matthew Crawford. What do you want to say about him?
Genius. He is super, super articulate on the idea that when we work and order the world, work on and order the world around us, that we are also being rightly ordered ourselves, which has been just a, that was like a revolutionary idea for me and has given a lot of purpose, a lot of meaning to my work in plumbing. Another individual who is good for this and somebody that Crawford mentioned a couple times is Richard Sennett. He has a book called The Craftsman, and it's actually the first of a trilogy. And I've only read the first book, but the second and third book are, so the first one is like, we build. The second one is we build together. And then the third one is what we build together. So the first one is about building. The second one is about community, togetherness. And then the third one is about the society that we build as we build together. So really, really interesting ideas there. Boethius is a must.
Boethius, I hope you just, Boethius, everybody has to read Boethius. Constellation of Philosophy changed my life. Yes.
Yeah, it's such an amazing mix. I mean, kind of Greek philosophy broadly is helpful in a lot of this, just because a lot of the literature is calling back to Greek philosophy. It's not Greek philosophy proper, the texts or anything, but like it relies on a lot of those ideas. So sometimes having that underpinning is good. Alistair McIntyre talking about virtue is helpful. Yeah. Gosh, King's North, obviously.
Those are all great. So you've given us your optimist and doomer take. You've given us some people to read, some things to think about. You've given us some background. Finally, you have a website, the Blue Collar. Excuse me, the Blue Scholar. It's nice, Blue Scholar.
Yeah, it's I've migrated everything to Substack, so it's the Blue Substack. You just go to, just if you go to Google and type in the dollar, it'll probably bring up. I still have the website. I'm just not doing anything with it at the moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, find me on
People
Substack.
Want to write for you? Can they write for you? Can they submit something to you and you look through it and see if you want to post it?
I would love to get to that point. Yeah, because I think there's more and more people who are in sort of a camp. That are thinking about these kinds of things and write about them. So yeah, if you are somebody who works in the physical material in some way and you want and are reflecting what you're doing and would like to write about it, I would love to host an essay or just any kind of piece at all, really. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Nate, Nathaniel, Oblate Nate, thank you for recording.
Yeah.
With the Doomer Optimism
of course.
Podcast. You can find Nate, Oblate Nate. That's his Twitter. Well, X Twitter. I don't know. It's so hard to like stop saying Twitter. Online on X, formerly Twitter. You can find him, Oblate Nate, and then the Blue Scholar, his Substack. Send him an email, send him a message. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. Yeah, and that's it. Signing off, going Godward, and Nate Marshall. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.